to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, a reminder that this is the last week of KABU's Winter Pledge Drive. KABU is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Not only that, KABU has trained thousands of people how to make radio all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. So help us reach our $15,000 fundraising goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. The Pacific Northwest has fought off two methanol refineries in Washington and an LNG export terminal and pipeline in Coos Bay, Oregon. But the frack gas industry still has this region in its crosshairs. TC Energy is full steam ahead with plans to expand its gas transmission Northwest pipeline by 250,000 decatherms per day, which is equivalent to the amount of gas necessary to service 1.2 million households each day. That's an awful lot of gas to be piping into a region that is clearly moving away from its reliance on frack gas. As we move towards electrification and away from fossil fuels, it's clear that our reliance on gas to generate electricity and heat our homes is moving towards obsolescence. Today we talk again with Columbia Riverkeeper staff attorney Aaron Saylor about the campaign to fight TC Energy's plans to lock the Northwest into decades more reliance on frack gas. Aaron, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
It's interesting that we're talking today about expanding frack gas once again, because it seems to me that just recently, the last big frack gas guzzler, the Clama Methanol Refinery, was torpedoed, and that was going to have demanded a lot more gas than currently flows through the Northwest. So why is there this new project to expand the amount of frack gas that comes through the Northwest?
That's a really good question. You know, So what's happening right now is the Gas Transmission Northwest, which is known as the GTN pipeline, is proposing a 250,000 decatherm per day compression-only expansion. So for context, it's usually one decatherm per day will fully support five average-sized households. So that's about 1.2 million households that this amount of gas would support. And they're really being pretty wishy-washy in their filings with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission about what the need for this project is. They're claiming that it's system reliability and market demand. But as we've seen over the last few years, Oregon and Washington in particular are really rapidly moving away from fossil fuels. And so we're arguing at this point that this expansion is not necessary at all.
Where would this pipeline go? Because let's actually just kind of go over the geography of gas pipelines in the Northwest. So where is this one and where are the other ones?
So Gas Transmission Northwest runs from the border of Idaho and British Columbia in Kingsgate, British Columbia, and it runs down through eastern Washington, through eastern and central Oregon, and then it terminates in Malin, Oregon, which is right on the Oregon-California border.
And actually, that name might be familiar from people who were fighting the Pacific Connector gas pipeline, because that was going to start in Malin and go all the way to Coos Bay.
Yeah, that's correct.
Malin's a busy place, I guess.
For gas infrastructure. So it really supports the eastern side of the states, whereas you have some other pipelines like Williams Pipeline, which is over on the more western side of the state.
So where are the population centers that are going to be using this gas if it were to be expanded?
So their largest customers are Pacific Gas and Electric Company, which is a California utility. So a lot of the gas is actually going all the way through to California. They also provide a lot of gas to the Avista Corporation and also Portland General Electric, much of which is used to support the Cardi Generating Station.
Which is where?
Which is in eastern Oregon out near Boardman. And then their second largest customer is actually the Tourmaline Oil Marketing Corporation. So the interesting thing about pipeline customers is it's a mix of utilities and distributors who are saying there's a demand for the gas, but then it's also pretty heavily the suppliers, the Canadian gas suppliers, who are looking for somewhere to send their gas. So we don't really fully understand where that gas is going. They have secondary markets that they sell it to. So I think that's where, you know, the big questions of what kind of industrial users are going to be using this, they're going to buy it on that secondary market from those suppliers.
So a lot of this sounds like pass-through gas.
Yeah, it does. Moving through to California.
There's also been this issue, and I hear this in every fight to try to stop frack gas projects in Washington and Oregon, is that the gas suppliers in British Columbia don't have markets, and they have an awful lot of gas, and they're also trying to get these markets carved into stone before the whole gas infrastructure goes away. So I'm wondering if that kind of pressure is one of the things that you're suspecting is happening here, that the gas suppliers in British Columbia just don't know what to do with all the gas they have.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident that that is exactly what's happening here. We've all of the investor calls. So Gas Transmission Northwest, or GTN, is wholly owned by TC Energy. You can look up online on Motley Fool all of the investor calls that they have. And in those calls in the summer of 2019, they were telling their investors that they're planning this expansion and it's going to be 40% because of demand and 60% because the Canadian gas suppliers need somewhere to send their gas. So that's very much in play here.
Now, what are they saying to FERC? To the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission?
That's a really good question. And is one of the reasons Riverkeeper is so concerned about this project is they're basically piecemealing their applications to FERC. So when they told their investors that they were moving forward with this project, they said they were going to do it in two phases. So the first was going to be the construction of a brand new compression station. And the second was going to be upgrades to three existing compression stations. And maybe we should back up for a second and talk about what compression stations are. So compression stations, they're placed about every 40 to 100 miles along the length of the pipeline system. And basically what happens is as the gas moves through the system, there's friction, there's elevation changes, but the gas will slow down. So they need to boost it. And that's what these compression stations are. And I'm kind of embarrassed. I don't know if this is an indication of how much Mario Kart I've played in my day or how much my kids have been playing. But I imagine those little, for any of your listeners that play Mario Kart, the little boosters that you drive over with your car and it kind of shoots you faster down the line. That's basically what a compression station is. So in the context of this expansion, they're planning to build one new one. And that one is proposed for, it's called the Coyote Springs Compression Station, and it will be just outside of Boardman, Oregon. And then they're going to upgrade three existing compression stations, one in Idaho, just outside of Lake Pendoré, another one in Walla Walla County, Washington, and then another one in Kent, Oregon. So going back to your question about what they're telling FERC, they're breaking this up. Instead of submitting one application to FERC and saying, hey, we'd like to expand the capacity of our pipeline by 250,000 decatherms per day, they're submitting smaller applications to FERC. That makes it a lot harder for the commission to really understand what the full scope of the project is. So far what we've seen is they submitted in early 2021 an application to construct the new Coyote Springs compressor station. They told FERC that this is a reliability project. We need it to meet operational constraints because of growing demand. End of story. And so Riverkeeper, we submitted a protest to that and said, well, hey, wait a minute. You're telling all of your investors that you're planning this big expansion project and it's going to involve a new compression station. And you haven't told them that you're planning to build any other compression stations. So it seems awfully likely that this is part of your big GTN Express expansion project. So that's one FERC docket. And then in the fall of 2021, they submitted a second approval for the three compression stations that they're planning to upgrade. And there they told FERC that they're planning to upgrade 150,000 decatherms per day, and that it was again needed for system reliability and increasing demand. So what happens is when FERC has to do the environmental reviews, they're going to be looking at two smaller projects as opposed to one bigger project.
This sounds like a very familiar tactic. I think I've heard about other gas companies, I think in particular, using the same methodology of kind of, actually, Zenith, that's who I'm thinking of. Let's talk a bit about this technique of like hiding the scope of your project by submitting very small applications. In this case, with Zenith, I think it was to the Oregon DEQ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, they're meeting the letter of the law, if not the spirit of the law. You know, they're really just kind of doing the bare minimum. And what we understand from our conversations during when we filed the protest to their Coyote Springs new compression station application, we ended up having a conversation with a representative from the company. And based on that conversation, it became pretty clear that what they're planning to do is build the compression station now as a reliability project and then submit another application after it's built to increase the capacity on the system using that compression station. So it feels very shifty.
Well, how can they get away with that? It seems to me, you said it might be the letter of the law, but not the spirit. It seems like it's actually a violation of even the letter of the law because they are withholding vital information when they're submitting the first proposal. And it seems like it's in their interest to not let FERC or any other regulators know what their full intentions are.
Yeah, and a lot of that problem is really on FERC's end. So FERC historically has always just accepted the fact. If a gas company comes out and says, we need this gas, or, you know, this gas company has, or this utility has already contracted and for this amount of gas and they need it, then FERC says, okay, then it must be in the public need and necessity or public convenience and necessity. And they rubber stamp it. But what we're seeing, and just in the last few weeks, FERC came out with a revised policy statement for how they look at these gas applications or gas pipeline applications. And they're starting to look behind those contracts. And they're starting to think, what is the actual need for this? Which is obviously very controversial. There's a number of commissioners that are not happy with the fact that, you know, they specifically said this is going to make it harder for gas infrastructure to be built. And then on the other side, people are saying, exactly, that's what we need. We're the current situation that we're in with the climate crisis, it's clear that we need to stop using gas now. So we shouldn't be building out, you know, more gas infrastructure when it's just not necessary or needed.
Well, you mentioned that FERC was known to rubber stamp these proposals. And that was expected when Jordan Cove LNG was first going through FERC. And yet, I think after the first FERC approval it got for it being an import facility, when it changed to export, FERC denied the permit. And they denied the permit three times, actually. Mm-hmm. So it seems that there's been a change at FERC. Now, that change shifted back during the four miserable years under Donald Trump. But the new FERC has came out very strongly with some different approaches to regulating frack gas and other energy issues. And I'm wondering if you are hopeful that the new FERC is going to stay in place long enough to really make a change.
Yeah, I am for sure. The fact that they came out with a new policy statement is a big step in the right direction. And then they also, on the same day, issued a new statement addressing how they're going to review greenhouse gas emissions for these projects. And then also just in the context of these particular applications that GTN has filed, just within the last week, FERC sent a letter to the company and said, hey, in your application, you mentioned that there was a market need for this. Can you provide some evidence for that, please? So I think that was a really great step in the right direction. And I'm really interested to see what GTN has to say in response to that.
Well, as far as greenhouse gases go, the timing is interesting because there's a number of reports that are coming out about just how dangerous methane is. And I don't know how well the research that's being released now percolates through the halls of decision making. But there's a lot more talk about methane being a killer greenhouse gas, and that in fact, by reducing the amount of methane releases, which are very easy to do, we would be much closer to our goal of major reductions of greenhouse gas by 2030. So what do you know about that?
I don't know a lot of details. I mean, yes, I 100% agree with all of that. And I think that that is reflected in the new greenhouse gas policy that FERC has put out. So they're not focusing just on carbon dioxide emissions, but they're also focusing on methane because they recognize that it's such a huge climate issue. So it's also, if you look at this particular project and what the impact of this particular expansion project that GTN is doing, when they upgrade or add a new compression station to the line, they have to do something that's called a blowdown, which is basically where they let out all of the gas that's in that segment of the system and just release it into the air. And that's, you know, a lot of methane that they're releasing in order to put these new stations in.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Columbia Riverkeepers staff attorney Aaron Saylor about Columbia Riverkeepers' campaign to stop the GTN gas pipeline expansion. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during this last week of our Winter Pledge Drive. KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, and people like you. So join now and help us meet our $15,000 goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I want to talk more about these compression stations and the whole physics of what's going on there, because I think people don't have much of a sense of what it would be like to live near a compression station, for one thing. Most of them, they're not usually in densely settled areas. Is that true?
That's correct, yeah.
So where do they usually exist, and what do they look like, and what do they do?
They are often out kind of in more rural lands near farmscapes. So, you know, for example, the Coyote Springs one that they're planning to construct is just outside the border of the Boardman bombing range. And it's in a... they're going to have to impact about 30 acres of cropland in order to construct that. So it's a pretty rural area. Some of them do get closer to town. So of the three that they're planning to upgrade, one of them is known as the Athol compressor station, which is outside of Lake Pondorel, which is a pretty big vacation destination. You know, it's not, there are a number of houses that are pretty nearby. And there's also the lake, obviously. There's an amusement park, there's a water park not too far away from it. So, you know, those do have impacts on people more directly. And some of those impacts include the fact that the compression stations themselves, they're usually pretty big. They span over a few different acres, a number of acres, with multiple buildings. So the gas comes in through a big pipe system. They clean out the gas a little bit, put it through the compression turbine, which was basically a giant engine, and then push it back out again. So it takes a fair amount of space for them to do this. And it's also really loud. So when they're doing a blowdown, for example, the decibel level of that is on par with a jet engine taking off. The regular operations of the facility aren't quite as loud, but they can be heard for, you know, quite a distance away from them. But also that turbines of the compression stations themselves run on gas themselves. So they have a lot of air emissions associated with them, even independent of the methane leaks that we're talking about and the blowdowns that we're talking about. So, you know, you have particulate matter, carbon monoxide, nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, and volatile organic compounds, which on their own are known to cause and contribute to health impacts, but they also interact with each other. For instance, NOx and VOCs react with light to form ozone. So these are, you know, pretty significant air pollution sources within these areas.
Now, besides Columbia Riverkeeper, is anybody else raising some concerns about the expansion of this pipeline and these compressor stations that would be built?
The word is starting to get out. It's kind of one of those things that we found by tracking the earnings, you know, transcripts, and then tracking the FERC docket, which is something that not everyone's doing. And I think that GTN was trying to use to its advantage to just slip this project through. But we're working really hard to get the word out. And there are a number of other groups that are really interested in starting to track and follow this, not just for the climate impacts and the air pollution impacts, but also for potential impacts on ratepayers. And what happens if we continue to build out gas infrastructure, and what does that do for clean energy sources that we're trying to build out?
I'm curious about the energy company that serves Bend, that they're one of the buyers of this gas. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I'm just wondering how the Bend community, which has become more liberal in the last 25 years or so, if they're aware of what their gas company has in mind.
That's a good question. And that's something that we're starting to look more into, is the utility side of this. You know, one of the, as you mentioned, one of the companies that's contracted for this expanded gas capacity is Cascade Natural, which serves the Bend and Redmond area. But Northwest Natural is one of GTN's existing customers already. So, you know, what do they think about this? The fact that they're pipeline company is continuing to build out at a time when, you know, they're looking into other alternatives for, you know, providing their energy as well.
Let's talk for a moment about Northwest Natural Gas, because they're an interesting company. And they seem to be, along with Puget Sound Energy, two of the leaders in greenwashing natural gas, so-called natural gas. Even the term natural gas, of course, is major greenwashing. And they're putting a lot of money into these campaigns about how green natural gas is and how it's a vital bridge fuel, which, of course, maybe it was 30, 40 years ago, but certainly not now. So I'm just wondering what kind of role they play. They might not need the expanded capacity that the compressor stations would provide, but I just wonder if philosophically they're looking for any excuse to expand the supply of natural gas that's coming through the region.
Yeah, they certainly are. I mean, my understanding from their involvement and listening in on conversations at the PUC, the Public Utility Commission, and, you know, all around Oregon DEQ's climate protection program, which we talked about on a prior show, is it seems like Northwest Natural is starting to see the writing on the wall, and it's starting, they can't rely anymore on this argument that it's a bridge fuel, because it's pretty clear that it's not. But what we're seeing Northwest Natural starting to do more and more is rely on what they're calling renewable natural gas, which is not really a great alternative. Like, they're never going to be able to produce enough to supply the system. It's going to be expensive. It's not really that much greater for the environment. You know, we really need to move towards more efficiency standards, electrification, that sort of thing.
Let's just go back. I know we've talked about this in other shows, but let's talk a bit about what renewable natural gas is. And I'm just kind of curious about how that plays into this whole future scenario for the gas industry.
Yeah, I mean, at a very high level, it's basically, it's the attempt to capture the methane and the gas that's coming off of, you know, for example, landfills or factory farms or that sort of thing. And they try to capture that gas and clean it and put it into the system. But you're never going to have a facility that's going to generate enough gas to really make a dent in demand for energy. And it's always going to be very expensive, too. And so we don't want to see Northwest Natural putting, you know, money into that right now. They need to be moving away from that.
But it just seems like that's their big thing. I mean, I've been getting emails about renewable natural gas, and then I see advertisements on the sides of TriMet buses and the Max cars. So I wonder how successful you think they are in this renewable natural gas campaign.
That's a good question. You know, I'm not sure what the general layperson who may not understand all, you know, they have very nice campaigns. I've seen the buses. I've seen the pictures. I get the mailers. I'm a Northwest Natural customer. You know, we see what they're saying about it. And if you don't have the time or the energy or the wherewithal or whatever to go and do the research to look behind what they're saying, then it does look very attractive for sure. Especially, I mean, like you said, their name itself, Northwest Natural, it sounds so nice and green.
Well, when I first started hearing about renewable natural gas, and it wasn't that long ago, it was like in the last couple of years, I think, where it started being talked about. And I remember having some discussions with people about, well, what is this? And one of the things that was a bell ringer for me was when I saw the statistics about just how little there was, and the concern that Northwest Natural would be putting renewable natural gas into the mix and calling it renewable, but you had no idea how much was really renewable, and it seemed like it was a pretty small percentage. I'm wondering if any more information came out about that.
Not that I'm aware of. I think it's always, just because of the difficulties in producing it and also the expense, it's always going to be a very small percentage of what they're using in their system.
So how would the expansion of these compressor stations affect, besides the compressor stations themselves being very noxious to live near, how else would they affect life east of the Cascades?
Yeah, I mean, it's largely a part of the broader climate issues. You know, if you look at Washington and Oregon in the past few years, they've taken a number of legislative and regulatory actions to move away from our reliance on gas. So, you know, that's still a really big question that we have with regards to this pipeline expansion, is what impacts is this going to have on ratepayers? You know, maybe not the three companies that have contracted for the gas for the expansion, but all of their other customers that are already using gas on the system. What happens if demand falls and they end up with all of this extra gas and nowhere to send it? What impact is that going to have on current ratepayers? And one of the big concerns that we have is, you know, it's usually the wealthier folks who are going to be more able to transition to electric options. So switch out your gas furnace for a heat pump. The lower income folks who are maybe in a rental situation or just can't afford to replace their system, because I will say, having done it myself recently, it is not inexpensive. They're going to be stuck with these higher energy bills, and there's nothing that they can do about it. And on that note too, this is unrelated to the GTN's expansion, but Northwest Natural, the PUC, is actually having a hearing tonight on Northwest Natural's plan to increase rates by 12%. So they're already trying to push up utility costs. You know, what's going to happen in the future?
What's their rationale? I've been getting phone calls from the Citizens Utility Board, and actually was invited to join the meeting tonight, which I can't go to, but good for CUB. I really appreciate them being there fighting for us. But what is Northwest Natural's reasoning for this increase, this rather large increase? It's sort of, well, as an aside, I was watching gas prices go up yesterday, and I went by a gas station on McAdam, and the price was $4.89 a gallon, and I came back an hour later, it was $4.99.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So that's sort of, I guess, Northwest Natural's increase is even higher than that percentage.
So they're planning to use the increase to cover executive salaries, increases to investor profits, subsidies for fossil fuel infrastructure, and advertising expenses. So, I mean, across the board, as a ratepayer, this isn't something that I want to be paying for.
Do you think that CUB has a good argument in their efforts to stop this rate increase?
I hope so. And I will say Riverkeeper, we're also one of the interveners in that case. So we are working hard to make sure that the PUC understands the impacts that this is going to have on low impact ratepayers.
Well, we'll see. I guess we'll know after tonight what happened there. I just wonder how much clout you think that the fossil fuel industry, or the gas industry in particular, still has, or whether this example is flagrant example of Northwest Natural trying to increase its profits, basically, and its market share, that if there's going to be blowback, that people are going to see through this and go, this is not really what we need to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's always our hope. I think there's still very much this dichotomy between the folks with the money, the corporate folks, the politicians who want to see these companies, you know, they have really well-funded lobbying interests, and then the public. And it's really heartening to see the extent to which the public is rising up and getting involved in what have traditionally been very wonky, not very friendly to the public processes. And so the more that we can rise up and voice our concerns, the harder it's going to be for the PUC to just rubber stamp these requests.
I'm thinking about how much life has changed for so many people who have fought the fossil fuel fight over the last 10, 15, 20 years, and how going to hearings, all kinds of hearings, whether it's your Port Commission, whether it's federal or state regulatory agencies or FERC hearings, that has become the main social life for a lot of people. And that's been kind of tamped down because of the pandemic. It's not as much fun to go to a Zoom meeting as it was to go to these hearings. And I remember the first couple of hearings that I went to, it seemed a little bit boring, but after a while I was addicted to it. So I wonder if we could talk a bit about that process of getting people addicted to basically making social change through getting involved in very wonky processes.
Yeah, I mean, it's very empowering to go and provide testimony. And then as we've seen over the last decade or so, it's making a difference. Like Zenith is a prime example of that. You know, it was the people coming forward and putting pressure on city council to deny Zenith's land use compatibility statement that led to that victory. And when you're a part of that process and it works out in your favor, that's very empowering for folks to continue to engage.
Just for some people who don't live in the area who listen to this show, let's just very briefly say what Zenith is.
So Zenith Energy Terminals is a oil by rail facility in downtown, in Portland's industrial area.
And they came in kind of under the radar, so to speak.
Yeah, they came in pretty under the radar and started dramatically increasing the number of oil trains that they were running through the city. And that caused a lot of consternation for the city and the public.
Well, in a moment, let's talk a little bit about how we can get the movement to oppose the GTN pipeline up to the same level that the Zenith movement was. But first, I have to let people know that you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Columbia Riverkeeper staff attorney Aaron Saylor about Columbia Riverkeeper's campaign to stop the GTN gas pipeline expansion. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during this last week of our Winter Pledge Drive. KBOO receives 80% of our funding from our listeners, but only 10% of our listeners are members. So help increase our member ratio and meet our $15,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. So how do we build a movement for something as arcane as this gas pipeline, which for a lot of people on the west side of the Cascades are going to say, why does this even affect me? I don't live near any of these compressor stations. Well, I guess their gas company is getting some of this gas, but people don't even make that connection.
Yeah, well, climate change impacts everybody. And like Oregon and Washington and, you know, even President Biden have acknowledged, we need to move away from fossil fuels quickly. And so that's something that affects everybody. I mean, especially in Oregon and Washington, the fact that the governor of Oregon has already declared a drought emergency in Klamath County, I mean, we're going to see that more and more and more. And the way to prevent that from happening is to make the shift towards clean energy now and away from fossil fuels to try to slow down the impacts of that. So in terms of GTN's expansion project specifically, FERC right now is in the process of creating an environmental impact statement for the pipeline, the second application that they submitted, where they're going to be upgrading the three compression stations. And so FERC has decided to do a full environmental impact statement for that. The draft is expected this summer in June. And so Riverkeeper and likely a number of other groups too are going to be helping folks submit comments on that to make sure that FERC is really fully understanding the full environmental impact of this pipeline expansion. But like we talked about before, putting pressure on the utility companies too is really important. I mean, the utility companies, their job is to serve their customers. They might think they're investors, but the customers are super important too. And so we need to let them know that we understand where the gas is coming from. You know, we're not just focused on being able to turn on the stove and have gas. Like, we want to know where that's coming from. And we want to know that it's, you know, being done in a way that's climate sensitive.
Well, there is a growing movement to get people off of gas. I keep debating about this myself, but it's, as you were describing, it's very expensive, and we have a relatively new furnace, mm-hmm. so it's hard to make that investment again. But I wonder if, as people start to exit the natural gas world and electrify, if that kind of pressure can be amplified to show the gas utilities that we're leaving you, basically. I do see that sense of understanding that at some point you have to cut the cord and just leave this entity, which you recognize is not good for the world.
Yeah, and they are definitely seeing that pressure is happening already. A number of cities, you know, throughout the West have already started adopting policies that prevent new gas hookups and new buildings. And I think we're going to see more and more of that going forward. We're also going to see incentives in place that the legislature puts in place to try to help lower income folks afford to make that change.
Well, you mentioned all these jurisdictions that are banning future gas hookups in Multnomah County, I understand, is for county buildings. I think in the city of Eugene and in the city of Seattle, it's a little bit wider spread. So let's talk about this movement to electrify communities and what the gas industry's response to that is.
Yeah, I mean, so far they've been pretty opposed to it. Obviously, it's going to have a huge impact on their bottom line. But at the end of the day, if they're going to continue to increase their rates, then we need to ensure that there's electric options for people. It's also, in terms of buildings and using gas within a building, so there's been a lot of studies coming out in the last year or two showing the health impacts of you know, you're basically combusting gas inside your house. And, you know, I think about that now every time I'm standing there over my gas stove cooking, you know, all of the things that you're breathing and how it does have a significant impact on indoor air quality. And especially if you have folks that are already have asthma or other respiratory problems or kids living in the home, it can contribute to childhood asthma. And so, you know, it's not just about money and energy, it's a significant health issue as well.
I saw an article a few days ago about how all that leaded gas that was burned up until the 1970s has decreased IQs across the board for like 1 or 2 to 3 points. And I just was thinking about how all that natural gas that we are breathing while we cook could be having similar kinds of impacts on our health. And I think about that every time I light a burner now, and I notice that I smell the gas before the flame catches. What really alarmed me is a couple months ago, I was out on the side of my house with my new puppy. And I guess I wasn't at the side of the house that much until I got this particular dog. And the furnace kicked on and I started smelling gas. And we called the gas company and they came out and there was no gas leak. And he told me that that's normal, that when your gas furnace kicks on, it lets out a little burst of gas. So these things really worry me. And it's both the outside, I don't like having gas leaks, even if they're only for a moment. But of course, it's the methane that I'm contributing to climate change. Inside, I'm very concerned about the health. And I wonder how we can address that. I know that there were some bills that were passed by the Oregon legislature last week that start to address the inequities you mentioned about how difficult it is for low-income people to be able to afford to electrify. So let's talk about how we envision making that difference so it's not only wealthy people that don't have to worry about breathing natural gas in their homes.
Yeah, and I'll share one scary gas story that we had last summer too. We were staying in a vacation home and all the carbon monoxide detectors went off, and I have 3 kids, and so we grabbed them. We're already in bed, ran outside, called the fire department. It was very exciting for the kids, but it turned out that they had a gas water heater that had just completely stopped working and was just releasing gas and carbon monoxide into the house. And so, you know, I hope that more people can see that you don't have to have that risk inside your home. You can switch to electric options. In terms of what, you know, the legislature can do about it, we definitely need to see more rebate options, tax rebates, discounts, anything that they can do to help make it more affordable for lower income folks to make this switch. And then hopefully over time, you know, I could see at some point in the future, perhaps there being a ban on putting a new furnace in. So if your furnace dies, you can't replace it with another gas furnace. You have to replace it with an electric option. And hopefully there'll be enough incentives in place to make the price comparable. So that's not a problem. But we need to see more of that happening.
Well, the furnace guy was at our house the other day just tuning up the furnace. And I asked him how much it would cost to put in a heat pump. He said $11,000, and I have been fantasizing about getting rid of this furnace and putting in a heat pump. Oh, $11,000 is about $7,000 more than I thought it was going to be. So I just wonder how to bring the prices down. I mean, that's not your area of expertise, obviously, but it seems like we need to find some way besides tax credits. It seems like the cost of heat pumps maybe is still a little bit overblown.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm not an expert in it at all. I'm just pontificating here. You know, I would hope that the more, you know, right now I suspect, I don't know for sure, just suspect that gas furnaces are probably most of the market. And so I would hope to see that as more and more, as demand for electric heat pumps rises, that potentially the price would go down because it just becomes something that's more available and easier to obtain. And, you know,
well, right now, Northwest Natural Gas is promoting gas fireplace inserts. And I think that's a lot in response to last winter's freeze and power outage, massive power outage. We happen to have a natural gas radiant heater in our living room. We kept nice and toasty. And it was the first time that I stopped bashing gas, probably the previous 5 years. I had to admit it was nice to have that and to have a gas water heater that also was working. And I saw this thing, I forget which environmental group had a, you know, debunking the myths of natural gas and was saying that, no, your gas water heater is not going to work, your gas stove is not going to work. Yes, your radiant heater will work. And it turns out your gas stove, the oven won't work if you have an electric, I mean, most of them are electrified now, but if you light it with a match, mm-hmm. you can get your gas burner. So we were still using our gas stove. Mm-hmm. And our water heater, well, it has a pilot light, so that's mm-hmm. why it works. All these things you're not supposed to have. But it really made me think about the ways that Northwest Natural is still promoting itself. And I remember when we bought our gas radiant heater many years, like 25 years ago, they were promoting it as, I mean, they were doing discounts. They were really pushing it. And there were all kinds, I'm not sure, there weren't tax rebates, but there were major discounts to promote the idea of converting to gas, because that was at a time when people were converting from oil to gas. Mm-hmm. So is there a way for PGE and other, and hopefully publicly owned utilities as well, electrical utilities, to have the same kind of incentives for people to electrify as Northwest Natural Gas had 25 years ago to turn to gas?
Yeah, hopefully we'll see more of that going forward. I mean, one of the big problems right now, of course, is that PGE and a lot of the big utilities rely on gas themselves to produce the electricity in their power plants. But as we're going to see, you know, as of 2040 in Oregon, they're not going to be able to use gas to produce, you know, energy for the retail customers anymore. So they're going to have to start moving towards more clean energy options. And so, you know, as long as Northwest Natural is the loudest voice in the room, that's going to be what people see and are drawn to. And they just, you know, don't understand. Like, I'll say for my family, we do have one gas insert that came with the house. Didn't work during the heat, during the ice storm last year, because there was no way to manually light it. But we have an old wood-burning fireplace, too. And we put a wood stove insert in, which had a lot of tax rebates associated with it that we didn't realize until we had gone in there to the store to purchase it. So, you know, there are other options out there that are offering tax rebates for greener options. But hopefully over time, you know, other voices will be able to rise up and there'll be other incentives as well. You know, the problem with electricity, obviously, is there, again, it's really super expensive, but you can get battery systems, backup systems for your house where you store some amount of energy. So if you do have a power outage, you can still run your electric utilities and appliances and things. But again, very, very expensive. So we need more. We need the prices to come down and we need the incentives to go up.
And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Columbia Riverkeeper staff attorney Aaron Saylor about Columbia Riverkeeper's campaign to stop the GTN gas pipeline expansion. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during this last week of our Winter Pledge Drive. KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. So please support this vital community institution and help us meet our $15,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. So in the last part of the show, I'd like to talk about how we can build a movement equivalent to the movement that is helping to stop Zenith and that stopped Jordan Cove LNG and has stopped the Kalama Methanol Refinery, that will stop further expansions of gas facilities, gas infrastructure in the Northwest.
So I think that in the coming months, you're going to be able to find much more information about this. Like I said before, you know, Riverkeeper kind of dug in, discovered that this was happening, and now we're starting to get the word out. OPB ran an article a couple weeks ago, which a lot of other organizations noticed, and I'm literally getting an email probably every day from an organization saying, hey, can you tell us about this? What's going on? So we're going to be getting out more and more information, not just from Riverkeeper, but other groups that are going to start getting involved as well, for ways to engage. And so obviously, like I mentioned before, we've got the FERC environmental impact statement process coming up. Riverkeeper will certainly have a petition and ways to engage in that, how to testify before FERC, how to submit comments. We'll provide all of that information. So definitely check Riverkeeper's website for that.
Now, is FERC going to be having live hearings like they had for Jordan Cove, or is this all going to be done just through written comments?
My understanding is it's all going to be through written comments.
Because there's something about those hearings that really generates energy. So I wonder, how can you generate energy during a pandemic?
Yeah, and I think the more people that request a hearing, I think, I don't know what FERC's processes are for that off the top of my head right now in these COVID times, but if enough people voice up and say, hey, we need to have a hearing on this, this is important to us, then I suspect that FERC would consider doing that. They are, in the last couple of years, you know, not only have they been rethinking how they approach these applications for gas infrastructure, but they've also been putting a lot of thought into how do we get more public participation? How do we make sure that folks really understand what's happening and make sure that we can hear their voices? And so that's all happening right now together. And so I think that FERC would be really open to people rising up and saying, no, we need a hearing on this. We need more information. We need to understand this.
Well, I remember one of the main reasons why FERC denied, I think it was the second round of Jordan Cove permits, was because the pipeline was not in the public interest. It sounds to me that this pipeline is not in the public interest either. So I'm wondering if that's a case that can be made and if that will have a major impact before FERC.
Yes, for sure. And that's really been the focus of Riverkeeper's filing so far. So right now, even though we haven't had a big public campaign, we've very much been involved in the FERC process behind the scenes, filing briefs and things, letting them know that this is not in the public interest. You know, in order for FERC to approve one of these projects, they have to show that it's in the public convenience and necessity. And so, you know, the fact that FERC is now asking, can you please show us what this market demand is that you think you're meeting with this project? That's a huge step in the right direction. It shows that they're looking behind just these contracts that they have with utilities for the gas and considering whether it's really needed. And so I'm hoping that FERC will weigh that and say, you know, here's all of these potential environmental impacts. Here are all these regional regulatory and legislative, you know, efforts to move away from gas. They don't need this new project there. And so I'm really, really hopeful that if enough voices come out and enough groups submit comments, that FERC will really weigh that against approving the project.
Now, we talked a little bit before about ratepayers putting a little pressure on their utilities. What kind of form could that take? What should people here in the Portland area say to Northwest Natural, and how about people in the Bend Redmond area saying to their utility?
I mean, I think just basic public interest campaigns, just, you know, start writing letters, start sending emails, just let them know that this is going on and, you know, you don't want it to impact your rates.
Or our air, for that matter.
Right, exactly.
Let's talk a bit more about the climate change issue. I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about how this is, because climate change affects everybody, this is not just in Eastern Oregon, Eastern Washington, Idaho concern, but it's a concern for the entire world, actually. How do we embody that? How do we really start to put that out as a concern that will reach other people?
Yeah, I mean, what we really need to make people understand is that any new project that involves gas infrastructure is going to negatively affect the climate. Like, that's where we are right now in our climate crisis. And, you know, you see in the filings before FERC, what GTN says is, well, you know, we're going to have some climate impact, but it's only like 0.02% of, you know, world greenhouse gas emissions or something. And that may seem like a really small number, but it's very clear. There have been so many studies that have come out and said that we can't have any, whether it's 0.02% or whatever, no new gas infrastructure is what we need right now in order to turn this around. So we just need to get people to understand that even though it seems like a tiny number and it seems like, you know, it's like voting, really, where people say, well, my vote's not going to count. Well, this gas project right here is not going to count. Collectively, it makes a really big difference.
Well, we were talking about the importance of building up the electrical infrastructure and also finding a way for people to afford to go electric. But I'm wondering how, if this pipeline is expanded, if these compression stations are built or enhanced, what impact does that have on our ability to build the necessary renewable energy infrastructure to really go to a fully electric future?
That's a really big question that I have too, that I don't have an answer to right now. But, you know, I suspect that these projects are usually have a 30-year or more time frame. So by allowing this project to go forward, we're locking the region into another 30 years of gas use, which presumably, as long as there's all of this free-flowing gas on the system, that's going to affect the prices of clean energy options. And we really need to be investing more in the clean energy options and moving away from the fossil fuels.
Another question that I have is there any ability of state regulators to have a voice in this proposal, or is this all going to be determined by FERC on the federal level?
I am not, full disclosure, an expert on the utility ratepayers and PUC and how all of that works. But yes, if there's going to be an impact on ratepayers, then the PUC is definitely going to need to be involved in that. And so that's something that we're looking into more as we get further into the campaign.
Well, one question I've had from the beginning of this interview is, I just wonder, how does Riverkeeper figure out what to go after? How do you figure out what to even research to come up with discovering projects like this?
Well, I think Dan Sears, our conservation director, gets the credit for this. I don't know what took him to TC Energy's earnings statement transcripts, but, you know, he was there and he noticed the fact that they were talking about this expansion project, and we just started tracking it from there. So, you know, we knew that they were going to have to seek approval from FERC from it. And so you can sign up on FERC to get notices if certain gas companies, whichever one you want to put in there, files an application, you'll get a notice. And so that's what happened in this case. We knew the project was potentially coming. We were kind of keeping an eye on it. And then once the FERC application started coming in, we started engaging more.
So we need more people like you. I mean, I'm just really impressed by people, all the folks at Columbia Riverkeeper. I'm thinking also about people in Washington who were tracking the Kalama Methanol Refinery before anybody else had any idea. Someone like Diane Dick, who was really in there from the very beginning. And without these people watching and going to Port Commission meetings and going to these really obscure hearings, we would have so much stuff in this region that we don't want. So I guess want to thank you for doing this and just wonder what you're up to next.
Yeah, well, I will say that, you know, those folks, especially like Diane Dick and others, there's so many that, you know, really support us too, where they happen to dive into the SEC filings or the port filings or whatever, and they get wind of this project and they'll bring it to us. And, you know, if we have the capacity to handle it, then we'll jump into it. And, you know, in terms of what's next, who knows? We're still digging.
Actually, I have a thought for another show. How about talking about clean hydrogen?
Yeah. I think that's definitely, and for what's next, that's definitely a big one. There's a lot of these clean, air quotes, quote unquote, clean energy options that we see coming online right now that aren't so clean, like renewable natural gas, like we talked about, and, you know, hydrogen too.
Well, it's always great to talk to you, Erin, and I seem to be doing it more and more often. So welcome to becoming one of the unofficial co-hosts of Locus Focus.
Well, I'm always happy to be here and speak with you.
We've been talking with Columbia Riverkeeper staff attorney Erin Saylor, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBRU Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us during this last week of our Winter Pledge Drive by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Liz Carlisle, author of Healing Grounds. We'll go out with some music by Ferrin in support of the people of Ukraine. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
At noon on one day coming, human strength will fill the streets of every city on our planet. Hear the sound of angry feet. With business freezed up in the harbor, the kings will pull up on their hair, and the banks will shutter to a halt, and the artists will be there. 'Cause it won't take long, it won't take too long at all. It won't take long. And you may say, I don't think I can be a part of that, and it makes me wanna say, don't you wanna see yourself that? Division between the peoples will disappear that honor day. And though oceans lie between us, lifted candles light the way. Half will join their hands by moonlight, the rest under a rising sun. It's underneath the sun and moon, a ritual wailing has begun. And it won't take long. Part of what you're talking about, and it makes me wanna say, come on. And beware you sagging diplomats, for you will not hear one gun. And though our homes be torn and ransacked, we will not be undone. For as we let ourselves, but we're gonna let ourselves be free. And if you think we stand alone, look again and you will see. We are children in the rafters. We are babies in the park. We are lovers at the movies. We are candles in the dark. We are changes in the weather. We are snowflakes in July. We are women grown together. We are men who easily cry. We are words not clearly spoken.